Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. The revelations by whistleblower and former NSA contractor Edward Snowden exposed massive surveillance by the U.S. government. But it's not only the government that is indiscriminately sweeping up vast amounts of our personal information. It's also being gathered and used by corporations, some you know and some you've probably never heard of. In her new book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance, today's guest, Julia Angwin, writes, quote, "Any of us can be watched at almost any time, whether it's by a Google Street View car taking a picture of our house, or an advertiser following us as we browse the web, or the National Security Agency logging our phone calls," end quote. Julia Angwin says we are living in a dragnet nation, and she embarked on a year-long experiment to see if she could evade the dragnets. She attempted to avoid being monitored during everyday activities like reading and shopping online. She tried to obscure her location at home and while out and about. She tried to use encryption when communicating with friends, and she put her cell phone in what's called a Faraday cage so not to expose her location. But it was incredibly difficult to be anonymous. At a time when we freely share our information with the government and corporations, and at a time when they're gathering our information without us even knowing it, is it possible to protect our privacy and challenge these modern-day dragnets? Julia Angwin is an award-winning investigative journalist at the independent news organization ProPublica, and we are trying to get Julia on the phone. So in the meantime, I want to give out the phone number and ask you to call in about these issues. When the NSA revelations hit the media, there was major, major outcry. But when it comes to what corporations do with our information, when they gather our information, there doesn't seem to be as much outcry. So why is that? And at a time when so much of our information is being gathered, what does privacy really mean to you? You can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866 798-8255. When Julia was looking at her Google searches, she found that she was conducting 26,000 searches a month, which revealed a lot of information. And joining us now is Julia Angwin. She's an award-winning journalist with ProPublica. From 2000 to 2013, she was a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, where she led a privacy investigative team that was a finalist for a Pulitzer in explanatory reporting. Hi, Julia. Welcome to the show.
It's great to be here.
It's great to have you. Wow, what a fascinating book. I mean, it was really interesting to read about what corporations are doing with our information and how they're gathering it. Before we dive in and talk about the experiment you conducted, your book is called Dragnet Nation. What is a dragnet?
That's a great question. So dragnets are what I call basically the vast indiscriminate tracking that is becoming commonplace these days. So basically the idea is that, you know, you're not a suspect of a crime. You normally wouldn't have been in any police files, but in today's world, you now have records because they have the ability to pull up information about everyone in a dragnet, whether or not they're a suspect or not.
And so any of us can be watched or followed at almost any time.
Yes, it's true, because technology has broken through all the boundaries that we thought we had that protected our privacy, right? When we were in our homes, we thought the walls protected us, but we're on our computer, and that's basically a pipeline that's piping everything out, and millions of people that we don't understand are also watching the conversations that we think we're having privately on the computer. Similarly, you know, drones are flying around, and that can change the view. People's backyards could be seen, you know, so there's just, technology has changed what we consider private space, and there's less and less of it available.
I loved the part in your book where you visited the Stasi archive in the East German secret police. You actually went to Germany, and you talked to the director about the extent of current U.S. government surveillance capabilities, and he was really excited to talk to you. And I think this really just says a lot about what we're facing. He said, quote, "The Stasi would have loved this." Can you talk? Did that surprise you when you heard him say that?
It did surprise me, because the Stasi, the East German secret police, were so incredibly effective, right? They were the most repressive secret police in modern history. They had the entire population living in fear, and there was a feeling that they were really surveilling everyone. But in fact, when I went and looked at the files, you know, they're not as detailed as even robust Facebook profile might be. I mean, for some people, the very few that they really wanted to follow, they had, you know, binders and binders and binders of information. But for regular people, they didn't have that much at all.
And so that's what's different about what we're dealing with now, is they've got access to information from everyone.
Right. So that's the ubiquity of the surveillance is so much more vast now. Now, of course, it's worth pointing out that obviously we are not living in East Germany, and there's like other parts of the repressive regime that are missing, thank God, from our life. And we need to make sure we're mindful of the fact that they did so much repression with so little data, right? And we have so much data. So how can we guard against anyone using it for that kind of repression again?
So from 2000 to 2013, you were a reporter at the Wall Street Journal, and you led a privacy investigative team focusing on these issues. What has really changed? I mean, so much has changed just in the last 2 to 5 years, but what's really struck you about how companies are able to use technology and the government to really track us?
Well, to be honest, I mean, the Snowden revelations are sort of this incredible bombshell that has landed, right? Before that, I was writing about privacy, and I was writing about what companies found and what governments found, and I had some inkling that, you know, there were some bad things maybe the government was doing. There were hints and rumors about the phone dragnet that he revealed, but the revelations have really blown my mind. I mean, just last week we saw that they're collecting pictures people were of their video web chats. You know, that it seems as though there's basically nothing that these spy agencies weren't getting their hands on. That they were breaking into things that they or grabbing anything they could get from anywhere in the digital realm.
Well, and we often hear about technologies that do allow us to surf privately, for example, or send encrypted email. But, I mean, it's fascinating to read about your journey because you dedicated so much of your time to trying to remain anonymous. What really sparked this experiment?
So what sparked it was I had been writing, as you mentioned, for the Wall Street Journal about privacy and writing all these stories about, oh, you're being tracked here and the police are tracking you there and this company is tracking you there. And I started to feel that people would feel hopeless reading my stories and thinking, you know what, there's no reason to try to protect yourself because, you know, it's all out there. So I thought, I'm going to do an investigation into whether you can try to protect yourself, whether you can control your data. And I launched this 1 year of trying to do it, and I have to say, it wasn't that successful. You know, it's not that easy in today's world to really get any benefits of the modern world without also exchanging your data.
What was most important to you when you started off? What was the one piece of information that you wanted to keep private, and why?
Well, the thing that I actually am most concerned about is my communications and my contact list, because as a journalist, I just don't feel that I can promise any confidentiality to any sources if they think that they will be identified as having talked to me or if somebody will see what they've written to me. So those are really sensitive categories for me. And that's why I ended up having to quit LinkedIn and unfriend everyone on Facebook, because basically those lists of associations were just too revealing for me.
What do you mean?
I mean, the thing is, when you connect to somebody on these, your connection, on Facebook, your friends or your connections on LinkedIn are basically viewable by the public, not always in entirety, but certainly to anyone who shares a connection. And so that shows who you're connected to. And so that was sort of like putting my address book online.
So you got rid of your accounts?
I got rid of my LinkedIn account, and I unfriended everyone on Facebook because I felt I still needed a Facebook page, which basically just says, I'm not here.
Well, so that's interesting. I mean, what else can you do to try to secure your private communication?
So the other things I did for my communications was try to encrypt more. So I put encryption software on my computer and on my phone, and I tried all different ways of using encryption. The problem was that both parties have to be encrypted. So it's all very well and good for me to have encryption software, but the people I'm talking to also need to use it, and it's often not that easy to use. So the chapter in my book about this is called Lonely Codes, because it was a rather lonely experience. You know, I got some of my friends to do it. My husband refused. You know, it wasn't that easy to convince people to use this very cumbersome software.
Talk a little bit about also the precautions you took to make sure that your cell phone conversations were private.
Well, the cell phone was a really difficult one because the cell phone is with you all the time, and is the best tracking device known to man, right? I mean, any spy would dream of something that people bring and put next to their bed at night. Mm-hmm. So I basically realized that as a mom with two kids, that I couldn't be out of reach. I wasn't going to be able to abandon the cell phone. So I got a prepaid disposable phone, not in my name, and carried that for a while. But that was a pain because it didn't have any of my information in it. I didn't want to check my email from it, et cetera. And so it wasn't that useful. I didn't have a lot of my phone numbers there. And it still was communicating with the tower, so I'm still locatable if somebody really, you know, if the government wants to find me or some commercial entities, you know, it was a Google Android phone. So it wasn't that successful. So then I got a bag to put it in, which was like a metal-lined bag that blocks the signal. So I could put it in that in between using it, which was sort of useful, but basically also means you can't get any calls.
You write that most cell phone providers store call detail records for about 2 years. AT&T stores them for between 5 and 7 years. And in the end, you decided they were all basically equivalent except for AT&T. And then you also chose a prepaid plan from Virgin Mobile.
Yes, right. I mean, basically, I realized there wasn't going to be one out there that was going to offer me no data storage. You know, I did, you know, for instance, on email I found and instant messaging I found programs where they literally didn't store any data. But on phones, none of these providers are offering sort of this privacy-protecting, we don't store any of your call logs. And, of course, that is also in part probably because the government, it turns out, as we learned from Snowden, have been collecting all those call logs for 7 years now, every single call made in the U.S.
You also identified 58 companies that are in the mobile location tracking business, and they range from advertisers to people tracking phones from the recycling bin. And I'm guessing, well, I haven't heard of many of these companies. I mean, what's interesting about all this is we all know Facebook, Google, Twitter, LinkedIn, but there's so many companies that are in this business that most of us have never heard of.
Yes, that was shocking to me, too, because I actually thought I sort of knew a bunch of them, and then there were so many more than I knew, even after 3 years of doing investigative reporting on this topic. But the location business is a really hot one. This past year, it seems to have really taken off. Basically, when you have Wi-Fi turned on your phone, it is transmitting to nearby Wi-Fi spots. And so people who want to get into the phone tracking business but aren't cell phone carriers or the government, this is their way. So they can set up a little Wi-Fi unit that connects to all the phones that go by, and all of a sudden they're monitoring the traffic. That, you know, retailers are doing this in shopping malls to see where do people walk, what's the walking pattern. You know, it sort of seems benign, but at the same time, it's one of those things where you're like, really, you think it's okay to track me as I'm walking around? You know, it just feels very unfair. You don't even know who these people are. You don't have a relationship with them.
Well, and why are they doing that? Oh, I mean, what's the point of knowing what stores you're walking in? What do they do if I walk into a store and then I leave and 2 minutes later I'm in another store? I mean, what can they really do with me in that short amount of time?
Currently, it's probably not that easy to do that much in terms of, you know, what they would want to do. I'll tell you what their dream is to send you a little note like, everything you just looked at is now 50% off. Come back, you know.
So,
I mean, this is the dream of location trackers, is that basically just as a new way to market to you. But, you know, that's starting to happen online. Have you noticed this? I mean, when you go to a website where you, I've gotten emails that said, I saw you on our website. You can have 50% off of what you looked at.
Oh, yeah. I just bought tickets for a play. And every time I go to a site, there's a box for that play now on the website. But a lot of people would say, well, so what? I mean, I wanted to buy it. It's following me. But what's the big deal?
Right. And it may not be a big deal, except for sometimes it is a big deal. So, for instance, in my book, I tell a story of a woman who was at work checking her Facebook, and there were a bunch of ads for gay cruises on her page. And her colleagues were like, why do you have all those ads for gay cruises? And then they were like, oh, I know why. Right? And she was like, oh, I didn't really want to be out to my colleagues, but I guess I am now, right?
Huh.
So the thing is that you never can really predict when you don't want this data to show up in an unexpected place, and then it might.
We're speaking with Julia Angwin about her new book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And she spent a year trying to remain anonymous online and trying to disconnect from all of these corporations that are grabbing and using our data. Most of these corporations you've probably never heard of. And what questions do you have for Julia about what she did? And what are your thoughts on privacy at a time when, well, so many of us sign up with these services and readily provide our information? A lot of it is collected without our knowledge, but we do freely share a lot of things because we feel like we're getting a lot for free. But as Julia said, nothing is really free. Privacy is now very expensive. So give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You also have this really interesting story about corporations breaking into private forums. And you open your book with a story about the Nielsen Company breaking into chat forums for people struggling with mental illness. And Nielsen monitors online buzz for its clients, which include major drug makers. So tell us about what happened with this site, patientslikeme.com.
So what happened was that this site was a password-protected, members-only forum for patients to share information about struggles they were having as they went through treatment for various diseases. And I read about two people who met on this forum who would never have met any other way. One is a woman, Sharon, who lives in Arkansas, and Bilal, who lives in Australia. And they are very different. They would never have met, but they shared interest in comparing notes about their struggles with depression. So they were on this board discussing depression, and then they get a note from Patients Like Me saying, you know, this Nielsen company broke in and scraped all the data from this site. We're really sorry. Oh, and by the way, we actually want to remind you that we also sell all your data. And so this was sort of a double violation, right? So they were both unaware that the site that they thought was a private place was selling their information, and then they were traumatized by the fact that someone had broken in to steal their information. I think this story is so illustrative of why I'm concerned about this issue, because the story of these two people meeting on this board is exactly the promise of the Internet. This is what's so beautiful about the Internet, is that it allows us to find people that have our same interests, and we would never have found them before.
Right, and especially when you're dealing with something as private as a mental illness, and then you find out this website is selling your data to pharmaceutical companies. How is this legal, and how common is this?
Well, it is legal because it was disclosed in the fine print, right? And so they, you know, theoretically should have read the fine print of the site before they signed up for it. And that is what is so sad about this, is that so many privacy violations that feel like violations are really authorized because we don't have time to read all this fine print. And, you know, we have to start to be more aware that you can't, you know, we basically can't trust as many of these sites without looking more carefully into what they're doing.
So for listeners who spend time in chat rooms, especially talking about sensitive topics, is it safe to assume that that information might be being sold and shared?
Well, after I wrote about this story in the Wall Street Journal, Nielsen said, look, we're no longer going to create fake accounts to go into private message boards and scrape that data, and we, you know, so they said they've changed their ways. But I think it's worth remembering that there's such a data race going on. Mm. I mean, this story shows how desperate these companies are to collect data, and they'll grab it, just like the NSA, they'll grab it from anywhere that they can find it, right? And so that is what is troubling, is that even if there's good actors, there's going to be one bad actor out there who's going to probably take more, you know, be more aggressive about getting data.
And you write that the cost to store data has plummeted from $18.95 for 1 gigabyte in 2005 to $1.68 today, and it's expected to cost under $1 in a few years. So this really doesn't cost corporations much at all.
Yeah, that's the reason that they can all get into this data race and data hoarding, is that the cost is basically nil. You know, it doesn't cost anything at all to store all this data. And there's this feeling that it's something you're going to need later, even if you don't quite know what you want it for now.
Do you think that some of this is a little too difficult to understand because so much is going on and it's really hard to visualize what this looks like? Because, I mean, I'd love to talk about this with you later, but people are outraged about the government grabbing our data, but there's not that much outrage outside of really the tech community or people who really are into this issue about corporations grabbing our data.
Yeah, I don't know. You know, when I speak in public forums, I find that it's 50-50. There's people who are completely outraged about the corporations, there's people who are completely outraged about the government, and I can never quite predict how come they come to those different conclusions. But I think it's worth remembering that the government is dipping its hand into the corporate data all the time. I mean, that is, if there's one lesson from the Snowden revelations, it's that these companies are so irresistible to the government, right? The government comes to them with these secret court orders to get information from Google and Facebook, but then it also is hacking in on the back end. Remember that story about how they were hacking into the Google data centers?
Well, right, and then with this, the new report about Britain's surveillance agency, GCHQ, looking at millions of Yahoo webcam images, you have to wonder, how did that relationship start, and who did the government contact Yahoo, or how did that happen?
Right, and they are, you know, I think they most likely were taking it where they can find it. They got found a way. I mean, basically, the internet is this decentralized network, and wherever there's a weak point, they can get in and snag the data. And so, what we're seeing is that basically anywhere they can find a little trove of data passing by unencrypted, they're grabbing it.
And according to the Guardian report, they broke this story. The GCHQ was aided by the NSA, and they intercepted and stored millions, webcam images of millions of users who had no idea what was going on.
And there you go. Look at what, who really would, I mean, even in my most paranoid moments a year ago, I would never have thought that this is how far the surveillance had gone, right? And that's what's sort of endlessly surprising to me about it.
Well, and then in related news, sort of related, you write about a school and the kids received free laptops. I don't remember where the school is, but the administrators were taking photos of the children in their own bedrooms, and the children and their parents didn't know about it.
Yeah, this was in Pennsylvania. This school, they gave everyone these laptops, and the tech guys had installed some basically tracking software on the machines with the idea that if one was stolen or lost, they could activate it to find out where the laptop was, sort of like Find My iPhone, right, and then bring it back. But what ended up happening was that some administrators activated the cameras in order to spy on students. And the reason the students found out is one student was called in to the principal, and the principal said, you know, we know you've been taking drugs. And he was like, what? What are you talking about? They had images of him in his bedroom with pills, and he was like, well, those were Mike and Ike candies, which look like pills, and how come you have a picture of me in my bedroom, right? And so that's when it came out that they had been activating these cameras.
Well, and the scary thing is, what if that ended up on the kid's record?
Right, exactly. And that is exactly the problem of this world of total surveillance, which is that these innocent mistakes of data could haunt you, right? If they wrote down, even maybe he didn't challenge them. Maybe he thought it's easier not to. And, you know, and then all of a sudden you have a record.
Or what if they didn't tell him and just told the administrators, we have to keep an eye on this kid throughout high school?
Exactly. I mean, what do you think the watch lists are that, you know, people get pulled aside for screening is exactly that at the airport. It's some data that they'll never know about that's causing them to get extra screening.
We're speaking with Julia Angwin about her new book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She's embarked on a year-long experiment to see if she could evade what she calls the dragnet. She tried to avoid being monitored. She tried to obscure her location on her cell phone. She tried to use encryption when communicating with friends, and it was incredibly difficult. She spent a year doing this to write her book. So at a time when we freely share our information with the government and corporations, and at a time when they're taking our information without us knowing it, is it possible to protect our privacy and challenge these modern-day dragnets? How do you protect your privacy, and what does privacy mean in today's hyper-connected world? This is Your Call, and we'll be back after this.
There are many ways to take part in the conversation on Your Call, on the phone or by sending an email to feedback@yourcallradio.org, or you can just leave your message at the yourcallradio.org website. To join us live on the air, give us a call, 866-798-TALK, 866-798-8255. Coming up at 11 o'clock from the World Service of the BBC, it's World Have Your Say. Today, what do you want the country to do about what the situation in the Ukraine? That's the BBC's World Have Your Say, coming up at 11. Right here on local public radio, KALW San Francisco.
This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up tomorrow, we'll talk about what happens when parents fund public schools. In San Francisco, fundraising has skyrocketed 800% in the past 10 years. This is according to a recent investigation by the San Francisco Public Press. They found that this funding has saved classroom programs and teaching positions, but it's also greatly widened the gap between the rich and the poor, especially when we're talking about wealthy and poor students. So are you seeing this phenomenon in your schools? And what happens when taxes don't pay for schools? Parents do. That's tomorrow. And when you have if you have a show idea or a guest idea, you can drop us a line, feedback@yourcallradio.org. Today we're speaking with Julia Engwin. She's an award-winning investigative journalist at the independent news organization ProPublica. From 2000 to 2013, she was a reporter with the Wall Street Journal, where she led a privacy investigative team that was a finalist for a Pulitzer Prize in explanatory reporting in 2011. And she's out with a new book called Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. And we're talking about her findings and her year-long experiment to see if she could evade the dragnets. It was incredibly difficult. And if you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert.
Hello, how are you?
Good, thanks.
My question is, are any of these entities that collect the information, are they subsidized or actually created by government agencies? I mean, are there any that are just, you know, not business entities but actually governmentally related?
Thank you. Good question. Julia, are any of these companies that collect our data, are they subsidized or created by government agencies?
Not most of them are not, most of the big ones, but there is a there is a venture capital arm of the CIA that is in the Silicon Valley that does fund some startups that help the intelligence gathering industry. But mostly it's not a direct funding relationship so much as a government contracting relationship. So plenty of tech companies are contracting to the government.
We have a Facebook comment from Jason who says, Julia has done a lot of homework on this. Good for her. Hooray for ProPublica. The government could not grab the data if the private companies were not already grabbing it. What do you think of that?
Well, I think it makes it a lot easier for the government because they don't necessarily have the ability to convince us to give out so much data, right? When you're dealing with a government, I don't know if I want to tell them this, but with a Facebook or some other service, like, you know, you want your iPhone, then you think, oh, yeah, they need to know where my location is all the time, and then the government can go get it behind the scenes.
And you mentioned this venture capital firm that's in Silicon Valley that works directly with the NSA to fund startups. Where does their money come from?
I think it comes from the government, but they may well get private money as well. I'm not actually sure.
Huh, that would be interesting to follow. All right, well, thank you for calling in, Robert. Let's hear from Olga in Fremont. Hi, Olga.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I have the following question. A certain company asked me to sign an application for a job on the internet using a company called DocuSign. And there was the application was on my screen, and there was a place where I was supposed to click. And I expected the signature to be something like what I get when I fill out the income tax on the internet, an encrypted number, nothing more. But when I clicked, my identical signature appeared. Do they have a right to have my signature?
So when you clicked, your signature appeared on the screen?
On the screen and on the document that I printed out.
Okay. Julia, could you hear Olga?
I'm not sure I quite understood what the question was.
So she was asked to fill out a job application online, and they asked for her signature, and when she clicked, her signature popped up on the screen.
Oh, that's bizarre. I can't imagine I don't know how that would have happened, but it seems really disturbing.
Well, what do you do when, I mean, in many cases, it's hard to apply for a job these days or apply for benefits, so many things. You have to do it online nowadays. I mean, I was actually looking at the Affordable Care Act in California just to see what prices would come up, and they asked for so much information online, and I just wasn't comfortable putting it all in there.
Yeah, I have heard that about the Affordable Care Act, that the amount of information they asked for is just
enormous.
I mean, they ask for your social security number and so much information about you.
Right. It is a lot. And the problem is that if we could trust that our information would be stored securely and handled correctly, then maybe we would be willing to hand it over sometimes. But, I mean, there's not a company or a government agency that hasn't been hacked and lost the data. And, you know, we hear about these every week, Target and Neiman Marcus. And so it is a really difficult exchange because you're being asked to give up everything, and then they don't have actually much responsibility when they get hacked. They're like, oh, well, you better go check your credit monitoring, you know.
Right. So how does the law protect us when that happens, when there's a data breach?
So the law, basically, there's not a federal data breach law, and there are a lot of people who've been pushing for one, because actually most states have a law requiring you to be notified when your data is lost, but not all states do. So we're not even at the point where you have to be notified. And then in terms of whether you have any rights over it, like any ability to sue or, you know, rights to find out what happened to your data, or if they're going to pay for credit monitoring, usually that's at the discretion of the company that lost the data.
All right. Well, thank you for calling in, Olga. Let's go next to John in Oakland. Hi, John.
Hi. Good morning. Really fascinating show. I recently was reading, it was either in Forbes or Bloomberg Business Weekly, just a fascinating story on Tor, this whole onion router development. And I'm just wondering what experience the author has with Tor. What was most fascinating about the article, I will say, was that this was actually originally a government-funded project and still receives government funding to this day.
Can you explain what Tor is?
Yeah.
I'll listen to the answer off the air.
I think
the author will know exactly what I'm talking about.
Great. Thank you.
So Tor is basically a way to anonymize your behavior online. So when you're on the web, most of the time, if you don't use Tor, your computer IP address is automatically transmitted to whatever website you're visiting. And often that IP address can locate you to the block, if not to your actual home. Certainly mine, when I looked it up, was exactly in the exact physical location that I was in. So Tor lets you mask that IP address. So by using Tor, your traffic is routed throughout various parts of the Internet, and you can look. So I was sitting in my room in New York, and I looked like I was browsing the web from Amsterdam. So places that I visited, websites I visited, thought I was in Amsterdam. Sometimes, by the way, my pages showed up in Dutch. So, like, there is some cost to pretending like you're in Amsterdam. But it also is a little bit slower. So depending on what type of, you know, the time of day and how heavy the Internet traffic is, you know, sometimes it can be very measurably slower. And so Tor is something I used when I basically was ready for that amount of anonymity and wanted that amount of anonymity. But I didn't always use it because sometimes it just felt like it was too slow.
Well, thank you for the call, John. And Paul in Santa Cruz couldn't stay on, but he wants to know if you have any encryption software recommendations.
Well, the standard encryption software, which I use, is pretty good privacy, PGP. I use the free software version called GPG, new privacy guard, and that is sort of the basic encryption software for email. It is good. It's incredibly cumbersome to use. I've been using it for several years, and I cannot tell you the number of slip-ups and mistakes that I've made where I've mistakenly unencrypted things or encrypted them wrong. However, it's still a great baseline. I also use on my phone Silent Text and Silent from Silent Circle, which is basically an encrypted text, and they have an encrypted phone.
And what does that do?
That basically scrambles and encodes your text messages and your phone calls. But both parties have to have it.
Huh.
And so, but it's the nice thing about it is it's an app that you just put on your iPhone.
And what is that called again? Silent
Circle is the
Circle
company name.
So who has access to our text messages and what's being done with them?
Oh, well, we just saw one of the Snowden revelations about that, too, was a couple of weeks ago.
I can't keep up with all of the revelations.
It's hard to keep up with them all, but I think it was GCHQ that was capturing, like, all, everybody's text messages, you know, in the billions.
And so then maybe they do searches for specific words?
Yeah, we can only speculate.
Well, so that's the other thing, is so much of this, and you write about this, that a lot of this stuff is totally innocuous, right? So I bought tickets to a play, big deal. The play is tracking me now, following me online. But what about when it's not innocuous and there are real consequences?
Right. And that is what, that's one of the concerns about this, like, keyword search that you're talking about. So one of the things that we just don't know yet is how are they searching the data that they catch, these intelligence agencies, because there's some question, you know, I don't think there's anyone who really feels that if you're directly emailing some guy in Al-Qaeda to plan some terrorist attack that we shouldn't be surveilling that. I think everyone's on board with that idea. The question is, are they then also surveilling anyone who mentions the word Yemen in an email? Or how broad, so the question is really, how broad is the dragnet? And we haven't seen an answer to that. You know, what the FISA court has said, these are algorithmic warrants. So they don't have to get a search warrant for an individual person. They can get it for an algorithm. And really the question is, what are those algorithms? Because if they're basically anyone who mentions, you know, but, you know, for instance, one thing that Al-Qaeda always says when they're planning an event is wedding, right? We're going to have a wedding. Well, if they're surveilling every email that says wedding in it, like, that's going to be a lot of people.
Well, you also write that even if you take steps, like use encryption software, these corporations and the government are always a few steps ahead of the technology because they have so much money and people are working on these issues 24/7 to come up with even better technology to evade the encryption.
Yeah, I mean, look, the government and the companies are going to be better funded. If you consider this a technology arms race, which I think it is, we as the consumer, as the citizen, are going to have less funding for our tech armament than the big institutions. However, you know, I don't think that there's a reason to give up, because some of the tools, for instance, Tor that we were just talking about, which anonymizes your location, has proven to be really robust, and there was actually one of the many Snowden revelations was a presentation from the NSA about how frustrated they were that they couldn't break Tor. So I think that there is, it's still worth using some of these tools to protect your privacy. Most of them work probably. Unless they really, really want you, I think they are going to get you.
So basically, we really just need this information to make decisions, right? Do we want to use LinkedIn and Facebook? Do we want to use encryption? But we really need the information so we can try to protect ourselves.
We need the information about...
Just about all this all of what we're talking about today.
Yes.
I mean, because if you don't want to be tracked, you have to know how to take steps. I mean, you spent a year doing this, and you've got, you know, more information than the average person, and you even had a difficult time.
I did. But I think that, unfortunately, this is going to be the next step in tech literacy. You know, we all had to learn not to open those spam emails that were selling you things and people promising you money from Nigeria. And I think this is just part of the evolution of learning how to live online, is we are going to have to start using more of these tools to protect ourselves, because right now it's a situation where there's very few laws policing the commercial data gatherers, and the laws that police the intelligence data gatherers appear to be pretty flexible, right? Congress itself many people in Congress were very surprised at how wide these dragnets were that the NSA was conducting.
Well, speaking of laws, Art writes in and says, we can act collectively to protect everyone's privacy from the NSA by supporting a bill in California, SB 828, that would cut off California public services like water and power to the NSA. Support a bill in Congress, HR 3361 and Senate 1599, called the USA Freedom Act to rein in the dragnet collection of data by the NSA and other agencies. Call and write Senator Feinstein and ask her to do her job as chair of the Senate Intelligence Committee, which is to provide proper oversight and the NSA, not cheerlead for it all, as she's doing now. What are your thoughts on that, Julia?
Well, you know, it is amazing. There is actually, for the first time, it seems, some momentum politically to do something about the surveillance that has gotten so out of control. this is an interesting issue because it's bipartisan, you know, but Democrats and Republicans actually agree sometimes on the fact that they want to cut back on the government surveillance. There's less agreement about what to do about the commercial surveillance because these are businesses that this is their business, is having data. You don't pay for Google or Facebook. And so that's a harder one legislatively right now. There isn't as much consensus. But I actually think that we may find that Congress will do something.
All right. Well, thank you for the email, Art. We're speaking with Julia Angwin about her new book, Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She embarked on a year-long experiment to see if she could evade the dragnets by trying to avoid being monitored, trying to obscure her location, using encryption when communicating with friends, putting her cell phone in a bag so it wouldn't expose her location. But it was incredibly difficult. So if you'd like to join us, if you have any questions or comments for Julia, if you'd like to talk about what privacy means to you, or if you have any questions just about how all of this technology works, you can give us a call at 866-798-8255, 866-798-8255. You can also email feedback@yourcallradio.org or leave a comment on our website, yourcallradio.org. And let's hear from George in San Francisco. Hi, George.
Hi. This is going to seem pretty prosaic. We're talking about ancient history, too. Before the current generation of revelations, the Snowden disclosures, maybe 2 or 3 years ago, our friends were disputing a parking ticket. And in the course of doing that, had to call municipal agencies. And in one case, they were talking directly after waiting about 18 or 20 minutes in line, speaking directly to somebody in the Hall of Justice, when they decided they wanted to go a level higher and speak with a supervisor. And this was a pretty routine request, but of course, when the phone call was routed to the supervisor's desk, it was to a voicemail system which was already topped off, and there was no way to do anything, no message to leave if you wanted to leave a message. So they said, okay, let's start over. And they called back to the same office that had referred them. And this time, the phone rang and rang for an hour and 5 minutes, whereupon they signed off. And their question was, well, how could they know that this was us, that they didn't want to answer the phone? That's what I mean by prosaic. We're dealing with a parking ticket, of all things. So the question is, have you considered the extent to which government agencies and everyday agencies have been penetrated by this system of thinking and have already given up and decided that they have to adopt spyware to deal with their customers? And are they tracking us when we make simple phone calls?
Well, and maybe they were using caller ID? Julia, what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, they may well have been, but I also, it is actually surprising. There is a commercial, there are some companies that sell what they call like call routing software, which basically tries to assess how annoying the caller is going to be, and what kind of things they might want, and route them based on that. I think it's mostly used much more on like customer service lines for big companies, and like known repeat callers can be plugged into the system and like sent to one way and then another. But there's also some sort of scoring system where they basically score you on like what kind of caller you are. And so it sounds, you know, paranoid, but actually this is happening. Now, I don't know if it's happening at the city hall because it's probably expensive software.
Well, I also thought this was interesting that if you visit a website and you, let's say, for example, I bought, you know, 5 pairs of jeans for $100 last year, then the website says, oh, she spends $100 on jeans. But then if you go there and you looked for a sale, $80 on jeans, they might sell us the same jean for the different price based on what we've spent in the past.
Correct. Now, that's what I think is going to happen more in the future. We've already seen some of it. So one of the investigations I led last year or 2 years ago was about differential pricing online. And we found, for instance, that Staples was selling office supplies to different people for different prices based entirely on their zip code. And they had made an assessment that people in certain zip codes could afford to pay more because they weren't located near a competitor's store. And this is a very crude kind of pricing. It wasn't about your actual previous purchases of office supplies, but we're getting to that point, you know, where they could have that much data. And we have seen the credit card companies actually have been the leading on the in this part, where they try to assess your income and a lot of things right when you arrive at their website in order to show you the right card that they think you might like.
So strange. I wanted to ask you also before we get back to calls, you write that retailers like Whole Foods are using digital signs that are actually facial recognition scanners.
Yes, there is a world of signage that is starting to actually be looking out at you. And and tailored, and you know, the myth that all these people say is like, oh, we just want to personalize your experience, right? It's we want you to have the personalized price for office supplies or the personalized credit card.
How
does clear
this,
to me, do we want the personalized price?
Well, so how does this work? I mean, if I'm hanging out in like the vegan section at Whole Foods and I look at their sign, then they say, oh, look, she's a vegan. Let's give her vegan things. I mean, what is the point of that?
Right. And then they never said what the point was, and they quickly sort of went under after that news came out. So we don't actually know what they're doing with those signs or how widely deployed they are.
We don't know where they are or if they're still in operation?
We don't.
Wow.
I tried very hard to get them to tell me more, but they did put out a press release about buying them, so we know they have them. We just don't know what happened.
Huh.
But it's... The thing is, what's worth remembering is, if it's not them, someone else. This technology is out there. There's no law against using it, and they can kind of do whatever they want with it.
Oh. Well, let's go back to callers. Let's hear from Linda in San Francisco. Hi, Linda.
Hey, Rose. Thank you so much. You're amazing. Love your show.
Thank you.
I have an interesting case of being tracked. I'm on Yahoo groups for feline cat diseases.
Okay.
And mention two words. I'm afraid to say them on the phone now. One starts with S-E and the other one is B-A. And I was flagged at the group owner email address, and I was red flagged. And they had to tell whoever was flagging me that I was okay.
Who flagged you?
Pardon? Who flagged you?
Yahoo.
Huh.
Yahoo flagged me. It had to be Yahoo.
Well, they do. They track. Sometimes I find on Facebook people lose their accounts or something happens because of a certain word they used.
Yeah. They do have automatic keyword software that can scan for words.
Maybe that's what happened with Linda.
Yeah, possibly. I mean, the thing you have to remember when you're on these sites, Yahoo, Facebook, et cetera, you're not in the public square. This is not town hall where you have, like, the rights of a citizen. Like, you're in a kind of a private world, and their rules apply, and they can kick you out for any reason.
All right. Well, thanks for sharing that story, Linda. Let's go next to Michael in San Francisco. Hi, Michael.
Hello?
Hi. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Michael Angel. I'm in Richmond.
Oh, hi.
Hi. Yeah, I have a quick question. I've always wondered, would it be possible to take this Dragnet system and sort of bring it to its knees by automatically sending out billions of text messages that have these words in them? I mean, I agree with the guest about security from terrorists, so maybe those aren't the words to use, but is there a way of doing that?
Yeah, there is. I mean, one strategy that I used in my defense against the Dragnets is what I call data pollution, which was I attempted to pollute my data with false information, right? So I created a fake identity and I had fake accounts. And I think that is, unfortunately, it's not something I would say is like the optimal thing in the world. I wouldn't normally be in favor of fake identities. But I feel like in this situation where there's ubiquitous surveillance and you really can't do much about it, that it is an effective strategy. Now, what he's talking about with, you know, billions of spam of text messages to sort of, you know, basically a denial of service attack against the intelligence agencies, now that's going to be hard because they have incredible capacity, so you're not going to be able to bring them down. But you can pepper it with incorrect information. The problem is that it'll be tied to you. You know, they'll probably be able to figure out that it is from you unless you take extraordinary measures.
All right. Thank you, Michael. We've got time for one more call. Let's hear from Autumn in Oakland. Hi, Autumn.
Hello. I deal with data privacy professionally to some degree. And like you had mentioned about Staples determining who could afford to pay more based on their location, my concern is when companies get together to do this using a third-party data vendor where many different retailers share all of your information back with an additional source, similarly to how we've always had credit profiles but that gets more and more detailed to the point that the offers that you personally will receive will be tailored to what they think you can afford. And I worry that as we get more and more young people online, that this will shape somebody's future in what they have the ability to access, because what a given company shows them, and then every other company that buys that data.
Thank you. Julia, brief response. We're almost out of time.
I basically agree 100% with her. That's my big concern, too.
So talk about how that might play out in the future.
Well, so I, for instance, always shop late at night, too exhausted, and I realize, oh my gosh, my kids, like, their pants are too short, I have to order. And I'm very price insensitive at that moment, you know? I'm just like, well, I need to find some pants to order, like, 2 days shipping. And that's because I'm a busy mom and I should be more organized. But I just, what I don't want is them to figure that out about me, and all pants at that time of night are going to be really, really expensive.
Right, or later in life, this person can only afford a $5 item, so therefore, I mean, that it just says something about who you are, and that might not be who you are, but you don't want them to have that information anyway.
Right, and have it to be always on my file that's who I am, right? So that affects all these future decisions.
Because it could sort of say, okay, this person's wealthy, this person's middle, this person's
right.
Not.
Right, and we are actually changeable. That's the beautiful thing about being human, is that we aren't always that same person that we are at 10 o'clock at night.
So in 30 seconds, Julia, how do you interact with technology today, and what is the one best piece of advice you can give us for those of us who still care about our privacy?
You know, I still do most everything. I've really found it to be more of a practice than it's something I do every day, is I continue to focus on my privacy. You know what I would tell people, though? The one thing you should do is make a better password. Because the most popular password right now is 123456, and that just needs to stop. Because even if you don't care about privacy, you should care about hackers.
That's a good one. It's pretty basic, but we have to be reminded of that. And also back up your data.
And back it up.
Julia Angwin is the author of Dragnet Nation, A Quest for Privacy, Security, and Freedom in a World of Relentless Surveillance. She's a reporter with ProPublica. Julia, thank you so much for writing this book, and thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much. It was great.
Thank you. And thanks for your phone calls and emails. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's your call. What happens when parents fund public schools? On the next Your Call, we'll talk about parent fundraising for elementary education. In San Francisco, fundraising has skyrocketed 800% in the past 10 years. That's according to a recent investigation by the San Francisco Public Press. The funding has saved classroom programs and teaching positions, but it has also widened the gap between the rich and poor. Are you seeing this phenomenon in your schools? Join the conversation on the next Your Call with me, Rose Aguilar, and you. Support for Your Call comes from the listeners of KALW. To sign up for our podcast or newsletter, or to share the show on Facebook or Twitter, visit yourcallradio.org. Malihe Razazan and Ali Budner produce the show. Matt Martin is our executive producer. Phil Hartman is our chief engineer, and Joe Burke is the studio engineer. Our theme music was composed and performed by Live Human. Your Call is produced by KALW in San Francisco. Special thanks to our partners at KUSP in Santa Cruz. You can email us at feedback@yourcallradio.org.
Reveal what goes on behind closed doors.
They don't want the public to see what I saw with my own eyes.
How the world really works.
If you got a $200 habit, you got to figure out how to get $200 every day.
Reveal. There's more to the story. From the Center for Investigative Reporting and PRX.
Join us Friday at 11 a.m. for Reveal here on Local Public Radio, KALW San Francisco. We're online at kalw.org. Coming up next, World Have Your Say from the BBC, which was recorded an hour ago for broadcast now. It's 11 o'clock.
Hello, I'm Chloe Tilley. Welcome to World Have Your Say. How do you solve a problem like Crimea?
The ultimatum is to recognise the new Crimean authorities, lay down your weapons and leave, or be ready for an assault.
That's a threat issued by Russia to Ukrainian authorities in Crimea, according to the interim government in Kiev. But Russia's defense ministry says it's utter nonsense. What we do know is that the Russian military is already effectively in control of the region. And as the threats continue, the US and European leaders are trying to calm the situation with a desire to pursue dialogue, not military intervention. Well, over the next hour, we'll be talking to Ukrainians in the east and west, as well as Crimea. Plus, what do you want your country to do about Ukraine?